Welcome to Season 5 of Let's Talk MedTech, and today it's all about creating the right environment for medical device products to succeed in the market. Spoiler alert, sometimes the best product doesn't succeed. And here to discuss strategies about creating that sound market environment for your medical device product is Holly Miller, founder and president of Gray Matter Marketing. We're also going to talk about the early days of surgical robotics too, so it should be a great trip down memory lane. But without further ado, let's talk MedTech with Gray Matter Marketing's Holly Miller. Well, hello and welcome to Let's Talk MedTech, Holly. How are you?
I am fantastic, longtime fan. So thank you so much for having me on the pod. Very excited about our conversation.
Same here. Likewise. I want to dive deep into Gray Matter Marketing and how it came about. But first, can we talk a little bit about how you got into this crazy world of healthcare?
Yes. Well, honestly, Omar, I don't know if it was dumb luck or divine intervention, but I had moved to Santa Barbara, California, you know, after college and was honestly just trying to figure out what am I going to do with my life? And so I was applying for positions and went into interview. If I'm being honest, I thought it was a computer software company, but it turned out to be the first surgical robotic company. It was Computer Motion. And my mind was blown when I saw the technology, and I literally begged the CEO to give me a job. And so I spent the next 5 years there, which was at that time in the late 90s, early 2000s. And this was when the category of surgical robotics was just forming, and Computer Motion was battling it out with Intuitive Surgical to see who would become the leader in the space. And then the company was acquired by Intuitive. And the rest is history, as they say, but it was this super crazy chapter and also a complete gift that launched my career and led me to found Gray Matter. So it helped me develop a totally different lens of what it takes to commercialize innovation at scale. And I think most people think it's about just engineering, a good product, but it's really how you engineer the market and change the way the market thinks and acts. And so that's my genesis of the space.
Well, lots to unpack there. It must have been amazing to be at the ground floor of just the birth of surgical robotics as we know it. You know, you were at two companies. I barely remember the first company you were talking about, but of course, the victor goes the spoils, right? We always talk about Intuitive, and Intuitive bought the company out. So that is amazing. Yeah, great piece of MedTech history there.
Yeah, it was really fun because Dave Rosa, who has done very well for himself, is now the CEO of Intuitive. We were like, little lowly peers, kind of competitors, but still, kind of friends. We'd see each other at trade shows and kind of trade war stories. But it was truly the birth of a new modality of surgery. And I feel very lucky to be a part of it. But it was, like the Wild West a little bit. And, people now think it's so well established, but it was hard to sell back then. It was hard to convince the market that minimally invasive surgery through robotics was, a viable and worthwhile endeavor.
Yeah, I can only imagine. I can only imagine. Oh, okay, you've got to tell me, as I was putting these questions together and I was reading through your bio, what is the product adoption lie? Can you shed some light on this? And do we see a lot of companies fall into this trap?
Love this question. Thank you for asking. It's one of those things that's all around us and we don't really we maybe haven't put a label on it, but the product adoption lie is simply the assumption that the better product naturally wins. So in healthcare, this sounds very logical, but it's wrong. Markets don't move because something is clinically superior. They move when the stakeholders believe the old way is no longer acceptable. And what I see constantly is, leadership teams confusing the idea we're ready internally with the market is ready for us externally. And so you maybe have great data, you maybe have all your milestones hit, your team feels confident, but then you launch into the market and the market kind of shrugs, right? They're a little bit indifferent. And so companies push harder, they hire more sales reps, they offer discounts. But the truth of the matter is execution can't overcome market belief that hasn't yet shifted. And so we see this constantly. 2 out of 3 product launches fail to miss their projections and they never catch up. And it's because the market didn't change your mind. So that's really the trap.
Interesting, interesting. Wow. I'm thinking about something that's kind of, it's not really adjacent, but it's a good example of this, but it's more so on the entertainment side. When you look at, it all depends on who's listening to this. Some of our audience will know this company. I know you and I will know because we're perhaps more seasoned, but when you look at Blockbuster and you look at Netflix, and I was telling my kids, my oldest daughter is like 14, and I used to take her to Blockbuster, and it closed like right after she was born. But here's my point. I digress. I was telling them that by all intents and purposes, Blockbuster should be here today. Blockbuster should have acquired Netflix, and Netflix should have been, an afterthought. Maybe the founder should have been rich or retired rich from the acquisition. But no, Netflix ate their lunch and bought them out. And by the time they wanted to turn the tide, so to speak, and have the little vending machines kind of like Redbox, it was too late. It was just too late. Yeah.
And that's a great example because I think a lot of companies, they might think that they're the incumbent, they're untouchable, no one can beat them. But then someone comes in and recognizes, wait, there's a different way to do this. Why do I have to go to Blockbuster and rent a movie? Why can't I, get it shipped to me and all the different scenarios? And so it takes one company to really challenge the idea of why does it have to be this way? Why do you have to go to the hospital to have your vitals monitored? Why do you have to, prick your finger to take your blood sugar if you're diabetic? Someone has to challenge that. And if companies don't continue to recognize that and evolve, they become the Blockbuster. And we talked about Intuitive. They've been very good over the years of continuing to innovate, continuing to evolve. They didn't just, set it and forget it. And now, 25 years later, you've got the biggest medical devices companies trying to just like even be relevant in this space. And now you've got soft tissue robotics, you've got hard tissue robotics, but now the next frontier is endovascular, for instance, endoluminal. And so like it's another chapter that's evolving. And, will Intuitive go into that space and dominate there? Or will someone else come in and redefine what robotics looks like in the ASC or in endovascular, procedures? And so it is definitely never a static scenario.
How do you keep that momentum going? Of course, you continue to innovate, but how do you continue that market message that you're constantly innovating? How do you keep that that momentum? I once wrote a headline that said Intuitive Surgical was like the Coca-Cola of surgical robotics, because you can talk to anybody, any lay person, and when they think surgical robotics, they automatically think of the Da Vinci or they think of Intuitive. And so how do you really foster, keep that brand awareness?
I think the companies that are most successful, we all know like Moore's crossing the chasm, right? Like it sounds very like rote, but the truth of the matter is if you really unpack what that model is showing, it's that you found people that you could solve something for them that they really cared about. You made them the hero. You allowed them to do something they didn't think was possible. And then they got very excited about it. And they started talking about it. They started to basically build a case for why this should be the new standard of care. And it becomes almost like this word of mouth flywheel. And most companies, I think, make the mistake of going too wide. They're like, hey, this can be used in every surgery, or this can be used for every patient that has this condition. When the truth of the matter is, find your strategic beachhead and dominate that space. So for instance, with Intuitive, both computer motion and Intuitive, we're trying many different procedures. We are neurology, pediatrics, cardiac surgery, gynecology, all these different spaces. The strategic beachhead became the laparotomy prostatectomy, right? For Intuitive, that's the space that they're like, we're going to focus on here. There's a great case for why this makes sense. Mm-hmm. And that was their foothold. then they figured out how to get better, or sorry, bigger, sorry, bigger, not better,
sure,
bigger.
Sure, sure.
And I think companies need to continue to kind of figure out like what are really the market needs that we can address that makes sense, that are adjacent. You wouldn't be like, now we're going into, I don't even know what, foot surgery. People be like, what? I mean, like, that just isn't the same thing. And so I think you have to stay true to your mission. And I think you have to find where it makes sense to go next. Going back to robotics, that really has been around instrumentation, right? But now really it's just how can we add more value around information, right? Information during surgery and connectivity during surgery. And so I think it's really having extreme customer intimacy and listening. If you asked a surgeon, what do you want? They wouldn't tell you. They don't know. It's really observing and recognizing that doesn't make sense. That's not, you know, not very efficient. Why do you do that? And I think those are the types of insights and curiosity that I think breeds companies to remain relevant and timely for their customers, which can expand over time.
Sure, sure. I want to pick apart this idea that you have that says investors don't fund products, they fund new categories. Can you expand on this a bit?
Yes, I love this question, so thank you. I saw a research report that showed that investors look at a pitch deck an average of 3 minutes and 44 seconds. That's it. So in that time, they're not trying to understand, you know, every detail about your product. They're deciding one thing. Is this the next standard or is this just another option? And that distinction, I believe, determines whether momentum builds or stalls. And what I mean by that is the companies that scale the fastest don't start by being better. Again, that's the myth that better product wins. That's really representing an incremental change, an incremental improvement. By starting to prove that the old way is no longer defensible, that plants the seed that, hey, we recognize that have reframed a problem that makes it seem like sticking with the status quo becomes irresponsible. And that's when valuation multiplies. And it's this idea of inevitability, you know? So the idea is if I'm already in a market, already well established, and you're trying to be incrementally better inside that category, your upside is capped by that category structure. You know, investors fund what they believe the market is going to change and rally around. And if they don't feel like the old way or the current way is under threat, then guess what? The clinicians won't either. The hospitals won't either. And the payers won't either. And so it's really this idea when they see you, they need to think, I've just witnessed the future.
Interesting, interesting. Let's talk nightmare scenarios. I always ask my guest about this, no matter what segment of med tech or healthcare they're in. What's one of the worst things a client has come to you with or that you have seen? And how did you course correct that issue, or could you course correct it?
I think it's a really astute question because I think it hits on a couple of things, which is like, you know, is the Titanic is going down no matter what, or is there an opportunity to course correct? And I think the earlier companies recognize we might be off course, the greater the chance that they will, you know, indeed like bail the water out and, you know, end up in the destination they wanted to. And so I think the two most common nightmares, they're nightmares for me, are that I lose sleep over this, even if they don't, is that one, they wait too late. And what I mean by that is it makes sense, especially in the device world, you are investing most of your time and resources pre-commercialization on developing the product and your regulatory pathway. And then you think, okay, check those two boxes, hire a commercial team, and like we're off to the races, right? We're going to, adoption will be automatic. What they mistake is the sequence of those three things. So think about it as a stool, like you've got product design, regulatory design, and adoption design. What companies miss, you know, what they don't recognize is that it's not a sequential process. You need to design the market, you need to condition the market simultaneously as when you are finishing your regulatory pathway and doing your manufacturing design hold, so that by the time you are ready to go to the market is primed to want you. And so the first nightmare is we're ready to go, you know, we're launching tomorrow and the market is like, why do I care? You know, why do I care? And so they spent a ton of money hiring more sales reps, you know, doing new marketing campaigns, going to every single event, trying to convince people that they're relevant when had they just started that process of conditioning the market, educating them what's missing currently and what the solution would look like, that would be a massive boost to early market traction, building, you know, momentum and word of mouth, and ultimately scaling consistently, which is what most companies struggle. They do not have reliable revenue. They are quarter by quarter trying to eke it out and are missing forecasting 70% of the time. And so that's one thing. You are waiting too late to educate the market why you are the most relevant and timely solution for them that they care about. The second thing I think is when markets fail to do that kind of in the right order sequence it correctly, they launch into a market that's lukewarm, basically. Mm-hmm. And so then they think, okay, we're just going to hire more sales reps. The more sales reps you hire, the faster you will scale. The mistake there, the nightmare in my mind, is that most sales reps, no offense, they follow the path of least resistance. And so if they can find traction somewhere, they're just going to keep fishing from that pond. And we've seen many companies that find that traction in, say, like the VA, which is great. But even if you got 100% of the VA, you know, market, it's not enough to scale your valuation and get the exit that many companies are looking for. So I think it's, you know, kind of a sales strategy. And I think it is a market conditioning, lack of market conditioning strategy are the two most common nightmares that we see.
You have to cultivate your market before you even launch. You have to make sure that the waters are okay. Interesting. You know, I've seen some technologies that are way ahead of their time and that just didn't make it. And I remember I was working for Thomson Reuters at the time, and they got a chance to, they had a partnership with Google, and they got a chance to sample Google Glass. So this was maybe 2014, around that time. And I remember I used Google Glass for the first time. And I've spoken on this before on previous episodes, and I've also done talks about, included this in some of my talks. So it won't be, alien to any of our longtime listeners. But what I found was that Google Glass was a good idea, but the market just wasn't ready for it. And then the way that it was designed, I was cross-eyed looking at it because it had one little, you had to look at everything on the left side through this one little speck. But the idea that you could have a wearable interface, I don't think they cultivated that market enough for this to be successful. And then the form factor, well, the glasses were a great idea, but I think that the way it was designed, it just didn't lend itself to being very successful. But I think there was something there. And as we see now, years later, wearables and having those interfaces are just, you know, it's almost commonplace. Yeah.
I love that example. And it's so relevant, mainly because it's like come back around, but it's such an indicative, like it's a weather bell of what we see too often, which is you haven't defined the category problem. Again, like why did people need Google Glass? What problem did it solve?
Yes.
And I think, you know, every kind of dumb idea or failed thing, my first question is, what problem are you solving? Thinking, you know, Threads, what problem is Threads solving? You know, what problem is, well, I've had discussions with my husband. He loves golf. And there's something called Tomorrow's Golf League, TGL. Have you heard about this?
No, I haven't.
It's basically, what's his name? Tiger Woods is Tiger like Woods, the innovator behind, our funder behind this. But it's essentially a virtual simulated golf match. It's in this cool, like, custom-built facility in Orlando. Mm-hmm. And they get the best players in the world. They have four teams. It's like the match is done in 2 hours. They have all these crazy rules. You can throw a flag. You can do a hammer. You can call different things. The course can change even though you're in the same facility. And my first question was like, well, what problem does this solve? Like, why do people need to play golf indoors. These are the best players in the world. They were just playing in Pebble Beach. They were just, you know, at the Waste Management. Like, what? And I realized, and my husband said, well, no one can afford to watch golf for like 3 days for 6 hours a day. You know, he's like, I just want a 2-hour match. And so, like, in some ways, that's a, you know, that's not an acute, you know, you're bleeding out, you know, problem. But I think many companies, to your point, they think of a cool idea, but they don't teach the market why it's so relevant. And I think, you know, that can change. Waymo, I live in San Francisco, like, that's a good idea. People are freaked out. Like, why would you possibly, you know, want to be in a driverless car? Well, Waymo's MO was like, well, if you're a woman, you might not want to be in the car with, you know, a male. And so it all depends on framing. How do you find that strategic beachhead? But if you just put it into the market, let the market decide if they need you, they may misunderstand you and think you're not really, you know, relevant or necessary. And then, to your point, either it goes to pasture or maybe it gets, you know, comes back 10 years later or more, like the QR code, right? The QR code came around a long time ago. No one even cared. COVID hit and all of a sudden the QR code has been reborn and, you know, it's everywhere. And so I think sometimes it is a little bit like the time and the invention have to align.
Oh, wow. Let's bring it back a little bit more toward healthcare. What are some of the general trends that you're seeing now? I know we talked a lot about surgical robotics, but any other trends that you're seeing?
Well, I think you would agree, like, it's such an exciting yet dynamic time, yes, you know, in healthcare. Two just quick things that came to mind, you know, AI is everywhere. We're talking about AI, how yes, that's used to, to predict, you know, response rates in drug trials, you know, improve diagnostic, improve workflows. But one area that I found a bit interesting of late is how really innovative companies need to rethink where they're raising capital in the AI era. And what I mean by that is that we're entering a new capital environment where LLMs are becoming the first screening layer, right, for venture capital. Yeah. So it sounds efficient, but I think it really changes the game because AI is trained on historical patterns, right? It clusters companies into known categories and it scores them kind of, you know, as in this kind of legacy model. But if you're a category-defying company that's truly unique and innovative, it doesn't look like old companies. It doesn't know what to do with you. It treats you as an outlier and it kind of punishes you. And so I think traditional VCs augmented by AI will favor companies that look like something it already knows. And I think if you're building something, as we were just discussing about, that requires the market to think differently, I think you are structurally harder for AI augmented venture capital to recognize. And I think about this as like an AI funding divide. Sure, and so sure. If I were, you know, a CEO, I would ask, you know, does my capital partner understand the adoption arc I'm engineering and are they optimizing for that pattern match? Because category creation takes time. You know, there's no overnight success in this industry. And so I think family offices and sovereign wealth funds often have different structures that better align with these longer adoption cycles. And so I believe, you know, increasingly they should be the ones that are backing these companies capable of really redefining the market in healthcare. And so I don't think it's like I'm anti, you know, AI. It's that I think it's structural fit. So I think where a CEO or a founder seeks capital now might determine, you know, whether your game-changing category really ever gets a chance to exist. So kind of a different area of AI and the implications on healthcare innovation and funding it.
Interesting. Yeah. What advice would you give to anyone who wants to be a part of this crazy world of healthcare, med tech, and life sciences?
Yeah. I say do it. I mean, I'm a person who, I was a political science major and a visual arts major. I was supposed to go to law school and I just didn't want to. I was trying to find, you know, some reason not to. But I think there is something really positive about people from outside the industry, you know, coming into the healthcare life sciences industry. I think it brings, you bring a different perspective. I always kind of say, like, it's wonderful to question things. And so I think maybe not growing up in the space can be helpful. And I think that, as you know, there's just so many important problems in healthcare to solve. We need as much help as possible, in my mind. And so I think there are so many interesting areas you can work in. It can be compliance, it can be marketing, it can be, you know, medical education, it can be engineering. Like any person that has any skills and interest could contribute in this space. And I think that's incredibly exciting and very refreshing in this day and age.
Well, Holly, thank you for coming on to Let's Talk MedTech. Appreciate the conversation.
Sure. I loved it. I could talk forever. So yes, thank you so much for this. And again, look forward to being to more of your podcasts. I always find they're full of insights and just makes me feel a little bit more connected to really interesting, smart people in the space. So thank you.
Awesome. And thank you for the compliment. Thanks. That's it for this episode of Let's Talk MedTech. Thanks once again to our guest, Holly Miller. You can find out more about Holly and the services Gray Matter Marketing provides at graymattermarketing.com. That's graymattermarketing.com, and the gray is spelled with an E. And visit us at mddionline.com for all of your MedTech news. Finally, make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to Let's Talk MedTech on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast.